Thank you.
We're getting very lazy.
No, that's perfect. Thanks so much for taking the time to be here. I'm going to launch right in. Camped near Silver Lake, California in June 1895. Can you hear me okay? Dane Coolidge writes his family a letter. He's on a zoological trapping expedition, and the letter primarily describes the routines of the trip, the pattern of the trapper's day, their concerns about supplies, their next destination. Mid-correspondence, though, Coolidge pauses, lifting his eyes to the scene around him. Quote, I see a little chipmunk on the fence now, and we'll stuff his skin tomorrow. We don't work Sundays. Skipping from the site of the specimen now to its future taxidermizing, the sentence elides not only the moment of death, but also the process of trapping, killing, and skinning. The animal may be on the fence, a symbol of indeterminacy, an index of territorial enclosure, but its fate is so certain it doesn't need to be written. Perhaps, though, this ascribes too much predictive power to the trapper. Say he does catch a chipmunk the next day. How will he know that it's the same one? Practically speaking, of course, it may not matter. The slightly ironic confidence of Coolidge's claim may have to do with the synecdochic imagination of specimen collection. That is, if the very reason to trap an animal is its representation of a larger whole, and if therefore there are other parts which are similarly representative, and if these parts have an especially robust fungibility when you're getting paid by the mammal, then skinning one is something like skinning them all. In this way, the chipmunk's doom starts to take on the uncanny form of a little extinction. 6 years after Coolidge writes that letter, John M. Oskison, early in a long career of writing journalism, biography, and fiction, publishes a short story in the Overland Monthly titled The Biologist's Quest, the text around which this talk is going to revolve. The end of the story refers to a zoologist named Cooley, who went down to Yuma to catch chipmunks for the new zoological park in New York. That park likely alludes to the Bronx Zoo, founded in 1895, and Cooley to Coolidge, Oskison's close friend. Oskison, a Cherokee citizen, had grown up on a ranch outside Veneta in Indian Territory, and he met Coolidge when he went to Stanford, funds for which Coolidge, the white son of a Southern California orange farmer, raised in part through trapping animals during term breaks. Coolidge worked for Stanford, but also sold specimens to the Smithsonian, the British Museum, and other institutions. He brought a notebook meant for lectures into the field. Once, when a stage driver delivered the wrong type of cotton, stuff for wounds instead of for taxidermy, he griped in his field notes that, quote, the driver should take Hudson's course on interpretation. Oskison's reference to Cooley comes and goes quickly. The story primarily follows the journey of another fictional naturalist. Although, as I'll detail at a few points throughout this essay, much of the story seems to draw on the experiences of Coolidge and his colleagues. They were close friends, and there was a really robust connection between field biology and creative writing at Stanford in the 1890s. We might, adapting a term from the Anishinaabe scholar Gerald Weisner, call this relationship a shadow story of a localized network of specimen collection and its textual surround. I cite Weisner because he strikes me as having real affinities with Oskison's writerly imagination, and I refer to his term survivance in the title of this paper, a term by which he means a lot of things, but among them an orientation to creative resurgent action that does not reduce to a mere fact of sustained bare life. My thinking about this dynamic is also informed by more recent scholarship by folks including Kyle White, Audra Simpson, Mark Rifkin, Patrick Wolf on settler colonialism and taxonomy, but I'm going to keep the focus, relatively speaking, on Oskison and on the archival material. What principally interests me about Oskison's text is how, likewise, that is, similarly to Weisner's concept of survivance, it alerts us to the conditions and the ideologies of survival by quietly recontextualizing his colleagues' experiences in the field, embedding the local practices of specimen collection, such as taxidermy and navigation, within two contexts. First, the discourse of species extinction, a scientific debate about which frames the action of the story, and second, the rhetorical contours of North American settler colonialism. The latter is a long-standing concern of Oskison's, and one could imagine that in this story he turns to the former, to species death, as a way of allegorizing social history. As Ursula Heiser has observed, Extinction stories often serve as occasions to register cultural desires, the sense that, quote, part of one's national identity and culture might be preserved, revived, or changed for the better if an endangered species could be allowed to survive or an extinct one could be rediscovered, end quote. Oskarsson's story about the rat might seem to fit that model pretty closely. I'll talk about the plot of the story in a moment. But I hope to show here that it also works to unsettle the typical logic of this analogy, tracing lines between forms of violence, slow and sudden, whose effects don't necessarily break along the human, non-human line in the form of an analogical comparison, but that instead register the entanglement of peoples and other animals, or in Linda Hogan's phrase, first people. The biologist Quest follows a specimen collector named Lake. He is hired by the Smithsonian to hunt for small mammals in the Rio Colorado Delta, where the river flowing across the current border to the Gulf of California widens out into a vast spread of salt marshes, or at least where it used to do so prior to 20th century infrastructural interventions. Based on the report of a prior field biologist who had been killed by, quote, superstitious Indians, unquote, the Smithsonian believed that a certain species of short-tailed rat might inhabit the Delta. If so, it would be, quote, a curious survival, and the scientists who could secure and classify it would earn an enviable reputation, end quote. So Lake goes with 200 traps, various taxidermic supplies, and in a horrific hyperbole, quote, a case of delicate, keen-edged skinning tools that he would have swallowed to protect. He's accompanied by two guides named Kitty Quist, I'll come back to him, and Joe Maria. Midway through the story, once they've reached the Gulf, Lake leaves them at the shore and walks several miles to the dunes where he hopes the rat might live. Becoming severely dehydrated, he experiences a hallucinatory vision, nearly dies, and is finally rescued by his guides. As they start to head back to Yuma, Kitty Quist asks him if he'll come back for the rat, and Lake shouts no and then mutters in explanation that he can no longer perform his, quote, strange medicine tricks with the rats, not with the short-tailed rats. So if Lake finds a specimen of the short-tailed rat in question, its curious survival disproves the extinction claim. If he does not, and in the end he doesn't, presumably the case for this species' extinction would be strengthened. Still, given that the results of a single understaffed excursion across a wide terrain could hardly be conclusive, it would seem that the debate should remain open. After all, survival claims allow for certain forms of evidentiary demonstration, among them, ironically, taxidermized corpses, that extinction claims may not, given the problem of evidence of absence. But when the collector fails to find the rodent the Smithsonian is after, the scientific community responds curiously. The burden of proof shifting underfoot, the question of whether this species still existed is closed, but the debate is reframed in terms of another question entirely, not does it still, but did it ever? Quote, Professor McLean of the Pennsylvania Scientific Society published a pamphlet in the fall of 1897 to show that the short-tailed rat described by the Smithsonian never existed except in the imagination. The scientific discrepancy that frames the plot signals an attunement to two things. First, the social milieu in which ecological narratives play out, and second, the way that narratives of extinction involve a dynamic relationship between claims having to do with A, temporality, the question of when that is entailed both by the predictive logic of endangerment and by the retrospective analysis of the fossil record, and with B, classification, in that a claim of extinction presumes or entails a species distinction. To put this point in narratological terms, we could say that a claim about extinction always involves both plot and genre. I'll return at the end of the talk to that scientific slippage, but we might first consider how it stands in relation to the text's other representations of mortality. Early in the story, Oskarsson juxtaposes models of interacting with and ending other than human life. One evening, camped by the Colorado on their way to the Gulf, Lake shows his Yuma guide how he performs taxidermy, catching and skinning lizards and a desert rat, but of only usual tail size. Quote, Kitty Quist watched with astonishment the transformation from a limp corpse to a flabby, empty skin, then back again to a cotton-stuffed, perfectly shaped rat pinned out in a scampering attitude. Donna Haraway has famously described the way that taxidermy can enchant the viewer and produce a sense of an eternal Edenic present, staving off anxieties of racial decadence in a way that makes taxidermy appealing to eugenicists. While Fatima Tobing-Rani has used the trope of taxidermy to describe the historical distortions of salvage ethnography, particularly the way that Robert Flaherty's 1922 film Nanuk of the North stages forms of Inuit life that had not been regularly practiced for decades. For Rani, quote, taxidermy seeks to make that which is dead look as if it were still living. The irony is that to look most alive, the, quote, native must be perceived as always already dead, end quote. It's an idea that Oskarson had been playing with since one of his earliest publications, an unknown sketch published in the Sanford Sequoia titled A Laboratory Fancy. And I think I feel relatively confident in saying that you're the only other people in the world who know about this. So if I get hit by a bus, you can carry the torch of this little find. In which a talking paramecium, removed from the black mud of his home, tells the student who it has him under a microscope all about his community's history and ecological vision. The student responds, "Of what, quote, of what import is your life when I must put a drop of methyl green on you pretty soon and try to discover from your dead body just where the living center of your highly magnified corpse is located?" I'm thinking of Inyaki's comments yesterday about and earlier today about forms of microbial life that usually don't seem to rank in discussions of extinction. But the biologist's quest also depicts a technique that differently mediates mortality, a snake dance. After Lake demonstrates taxidermy to Kitty Quist, the Yuma guide looks under a large stone and finds not a rat, but a rattler. As he grasps it by the neck, the snake at first writhes and hisses. With his slow gestures, Kitty Quist's slow gestures, it calms, and he's able to twist the snake all around him. Quote, now all motion had ceased, the rattler lay along his hand and arm, pliant and quiet as a huge cord. The unwinking eyes were still, and the rattling had ceased. We might take the snake dance as salvage ethnography, as an effort to transcribe and thereby preserve a threatened folkway. Kitty Quist himself seems to suggest that he is doing some work of conservation. His version of the dance remains robust, he boasts, whereas other practitioners have resorted to performing a watered-down version with young snakes. However, the snake dance itself, as Oskarson imagines this particular performance, and I want to be clear that I don't believe he's trying to represent dance traditions with any real fidelity to Southwestern practices, might also offer us a different sense of the salvage operation than taxidermy does. Kitty Quist, after untwining the snake from his body and letting it down to the ground, takes a moment to recompose himself. Then he takes the snake in hand again, but now, quote, with no more concern than he would show in handling a whip. Holding the tail, he whirled it about his head and brought it back with a jerk that separated the head and body and flung the mutilated trunk away, end quote. In contrast to taxidermy, here the living is made to look dead. All motion had ceased. And the outcome of this simulated death turns out to be real death, and not one that elides the process of killing, as Lake's taxidermy did, or as Coolidge did with the chipmunk. This, instead, is a violent decapitation that leaves the body unavailable to reconstruction, sale, cataloging, study, or display. In describing this death as simulated, I mean to suggest again some alignment between Oskarson's imagination and Gerald Weisner's account, which draws in part on Baudrillard, of the simulations that both express and materially extend colonialist hegemony, bridging the difference between real and imaginary. The simulations of absence that he discusses have long been addressed in terms of the myth of the vanishing Indian. As Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz and Dina Gilio-Whitaker have recently written, the myth not only lends a romantic pathos to genocide, but in doing so gives rhetorical support to the denial of resources to indigenous peoples with a particular intensity in its application at the turn of the 20th century. Oskarson was very much around for this. In his early life, he witnessed one of its instruments in the federal government's allotment of communal lands, as George and Kara addressed in their opening remarks yesterday, in Indian Territory during the years just prior to Oklahoman statehood. While Oskarson writes about these histories in detail elsewhere, they're not present in the biologist's quest, except perhaps obliquely in the description of Kitty Quist's itinerant history of employment, which is clearly conditioned by settler incursions into the West. He tells this story to Lake before they kill the desert rat and the snake. Although he had once, quote, been the most feared medicine man in the Southwest, This changed as the Yumas grew poorer, less energetic, and careless of the fame of their great man. End quote. To get by, Kittyquist performs for tourists. He serves as a guide for miners, smiling at their folly and failure. And then, after curing the governor by sucking his joints, he becomes a, quote, self-important white man's medicine doctor, end quote. And it's a sign of Oskison's trademark style that you can't quite tell whether self-important attaches to the doctor and the patient in that formulation. And now he was going to help the new doctor catch rats, for what he knew not. And next he would be, well, he didn't know. The seemingly radical contingency that Kittyquist describes doesn't in fact seem to make for much dread. When Lake is eventually driven to the point of insanity, Kittyquist takes his tools and sells them to the next comer. He may not know what he will be, but he has a sense of the next move, and he will, come back. There we go. And he will be something. His name itself seems to announce this fluidity in its lexical play. The first part sneaks a feline pun into a story about chasing a rodent, and the second part stands in weird proximity to the title's quest. In fact, in the first printing of the story, there's a single instance of Kitty, we can move past the cat picture pretty quickly. There's a single instance of Kittyquist's name that's spelled Kittyquest. This has been corrected in the only republication of the story very recently, which I think is unfortunate because I think he's done something with that. That term quest elevates the task of trapping by hinting of chivalric glory, if in the quixotic mode. In fact, Lake, in his bumbling itinerary across the dunes, is once described as scampering, the same term attached to his stuffed desert rat. But if I can name another pun that may already be obvious, this quest also plays on the notion of a vision quest. After the biologist and the guides have reached the gulf, Lake walks into the hills. At the same time, weather forces the guides to steer the boat a ways off the coast. Lake is left stranded overnight, runs out of food, gets dehydrated, and finds himself walking miles farther than expected because of the unique topography of the delta, with saltwater inlets breaking up the coastline at frequent intervals and frustrating passage. In this part of the story, Oskison draws on the experiences of another classmate, the zoology major William Whiten Price. When Coolidge wrote of the little chipmunk in 1895, it had been Price that hired him for the expedition. In 1898, Price followed the same itinerary of Lake and his guides in the story from Yuma down the Colorado to the sea and got lost in the hills and nearly died. But no accounts of Price's journey include a short-tailed rat nor a hallucination. These elements seem to be specific to Oskison's text. In a half-sleeping dream state, Lake sees the, quote, wonderful short-tailed rat swimming forever from bank to bank of a sluggish salt pool that rose and fell as the tide crept in and out. The failure of the quest issued by the Smithsonian is at the same time, in Oskison's pun, an unwitting fulfillment of the kind of vision quest practiced by indigenous peoples in the Southwest and other parts of North America, though it's absolutely important, again, to note that Oskison is playing really fast and loose with such cultural reference, operating in a parodic mode. This comes through in the contrast between the elevation of the quest and its object, not just a rat, the paradigmatic problem animal, especially so for urban magazine readers, but one with a short tail, a feature that is meant to distinguish the species, but that manages also to diminish it in its connotations, perhaps evoking castration or dismemberment. Putting its metaphoric function aside for a moment, I want to turn for a moment, though with some hesitation, to what may be a real counterpart to Lake's wonderful rat. Coolidge caught many rats, especially kangaroo rats, in Lower California and the Southwest, but with, I believe, just one exception, none ever fit the bill of being both short-tailed and semi-aquatic. However, in 1896, on a trip organized by Price, Coolidge went trapping in Santa Anita, Mexico, at the southern end of the peninsula. Farther south, in other words, than Oskison's fictional biologist traveled, and Coolidge never traveled down Colorado for that expedition. Along the Rio San Jose del Cabo, he caught six specimens of a previously unclassified rice rat, which would be named the following year Oryzomys peninsulae. The British Museum zoologist Oldfield Thomas published a note about the species in December 1897 and wrote to Coolidge at the beginning of 1898, Orizomus peninsulae is a particular surprise that's at the top there. In Seahart Merriam's Synopsis of the Rice Rats, genus Orizomus of the United States and Mexico, published the same month as Oskarson's story, July 1901, the species is described as follows. Characteristics, size rather large, ears rather small, tail short, color grayish, belly whitish, skull broad and massive. This short-tailed rat, a swimmer from Lower California, sounds familiar. The reason I hesitated to head down that path into the dunes of this claim about the real counterpart is because it's obviously completely unreasonable. Not so much because the story never contradicts the claim of the scientists from the Pennsylvania Academy of Sciences that this rat never existed, but more because the Pennsylvania Academy of Sciences never existed either, at least not in the form in which, not as an organization that would publish a text like that. No more than Cooley did or Kitty Quist did, because, in other words, a fictional work generates taxonomies irreducible to those outside it. Still, Orizomus peninsulae deserves our attention one moment longer, I think. According to a review of its classification by zoologists Michael D. Carlton and Joaquin Arroyo Cabrales, a total of 21 specimens have ever been collected, half a dozen by Coolidge in 1896 and 15 more a decade later in 1906. In 1979, and again in the early 1990s, field teams tried to find more. Like Lake, they failed. All 21 specimens had been found along the Rio San Jose del Cabo, a river that, according to Carlton and Arroyo Cabrales, no longer exists, having been sapped dry for irrigation products. There is a very small, it's an estuarial river, and there's still a very small trickle and some folks who are working on restoration. But in combination with nearby pollution due to the development of the Cabo area, that desiccation means that the only area where the species was ever found became at some point in the 20th century, quote, inimical for a semi-aquatic rodent tied to such a precarious ecological niche, end quote. The inference from all this is that peninsulae is either critically endangered or extinct. There were several decades from 1971 to 2009 where nobody thought it existed at all. When, that is, it got folded into a newly expanded description of another species designation, one whose habitat is on the other side of the Gulf, on the eastern side of the Gulf of California. But recently, its taxonomic status as a distinct species has been restored. This assessment was made based on morphological observations of physical distinctions, like that short tail, but also involved a hypothesis about the geological conditions of its phylogenesis. That its location in such an isolated pocket around Cabo had to do with the tectonic rift that about 6 million years ago created the Gulf and separated the peninsula from the mainland, creating the conditions and the time for an evolutionary divergence. The extant remains of the 21 specimens were able to bring this species back to recognition, if not to life. The same thing that happened to peninsulae's habitat happened on a larger scale at the northern end of the peninsula to the Colorado, which once watered the habitat in which Oskarson's wonderful rat would have lived. The itinerary he described for Lake has not been possible by boat for over half a century. By the 1960s, the Colorado River had stopped flowing from Yuma to the Gulf as a result of infrastructural interventions from the construction of the Hoover Dam in 1930, and then Glen Canyon Dam, and other water diversion projects that began in the late 1950s. A collaborative initiative begun in 2012 between the US and Mexico, known as the Minute 319 Project, in reference to an element of the 1944 water treaty. It was renewed in 2017 as the Minute 323 Agreement. That initiative has led to some effort to revitalize the river with strategic pulse flows of water released into the dry bed of the Colorado and also reduced diversions for irrigation. These have not had lasting effect in returning flowing water to the riverbed. The decades of desiccation have obviously had major effects on fauna and also on the people that have long lived along the river and the delta, including the Yuma, and also in the region closest to the delta, the Cucapa. In a recent study of Cucapa responses to these environmental and economic changes, Shaylin Muhlman notes that many people still living in the vicinity of the delta articulate the exigencies of their situation not through the question of the water's disappearance itself, however acutely aware of this ecological history they are, but rather through the difficulty of finding work, Quote, instead of situating the fishing conflict that comes from this desiccation in a discourse of environmental crisis, they shifted the terms of the debate onto the conditions of poverty that made feeding their families the ultimate priority, end quote. That shift is also away from a narrative of absence, the river that vanished, to an assertion of presence. In observing the surprising echoes of Oskarsson's narrative in the century that was to come, I won't claim for him the same kind of proleptic faculty that Coolidge assumed over his little chipmunk's fate. If anything, I think the biologist's quest develops a counter-narrative to that logic. Plus, part of what I've been after in embedding the text within such a localized context as the early years of Stanford University's zoology and literature programs, with the severe limitations of perspective that this may entail, is a sense of how ideas of species distinction and extinction unfold historically in relation to particular vocabularies and vernacular practices of identity and affiliation. Oskarsson's story, rather than a full-fledged theory of such relations, takes a local network of discourse and estranges it, in part by bringing it into direct contact with histories and social groups that usually remain submerged in the record. The naturalist guides, for instance, are seldom mentioned, certainly not by name, and generally not in reference to the work that they do in the other texts that constitute the archive of this milieu. With the imaginative, and just one or two more paragraphs here, with the imaginative taxonomies that such a narrative generates in its puns on names, its dubious species, its referential inaccuracies, it also produces curious chronologies from the sense of cyclicality implied by both the story's opening and its end. Lake replaces a prior naturalist and is then replaced by Cooley, will they ever stop coming, to Kittyquist's fluid becoming, to the infinite oscillation of the dream rat swimming forever from bank to bank as the tide crept in and out. These plural temporalities may be metonyms, I think, for the chronological manipulations of tales, T-A-L-E, themselves, of narrative implotment, which is sometimes understood in terms that sound a lot like endangerment. Peter Brooks's famous study of implotment, identified the anticipation of retrospection that structures the reader's experience of a fictional text. The death, metaphoric but also often literal, that we know is coming at the end, gives potential shape to everything that comes before, totalizing and rationalizing the meaning of the details along the way. But to get to the end, as Brooks also writes, you also need to move through all sorts of proximities, metonyms, desires, entanglements, the experience of which things does not in fact get erased at the moment of narrative closure. So when Oskarsson bookends his story with that odd shift in the scientific debate about the rat's extinction, he also, I think, registers this narrative dynamic, the movement from the beginning of the story and the question, did it still exist or not, to the end of the story and the question, did it ever exist or not, is a move from a question that threatens to remain open to one that allows for categorical decision. A judgment about genre, what, resolves a problem of plot, when. But the point is that Oskarsson makes this closure conspicuously arbitrary and dubious. And in that arbitrariness, he may provoke us to ask what happens to the concepts of extinction when we unsettle our received sense of linear narrative time. What I mean to suggest from this is that in attempting to reckon with extinction, what the study of narrative fiction may offer is a sense, first, of the discursive contingencies of our incoherent taxonomies, often contingencies that ethically demand our response as much as a potential disappearance does, and second, of the possibility not just of decelerating time's forward arrow, but of finding other ways to simulate it. Okay, thank you. Look forward to questions. It's been a long, deep dive into the archive, and I'm finding out, you know, trying to figure out how this speaks outside of that. So I very much welcome any feedback, criticism, questions, comments.
Thank you for really an awesome presentation. I apologize if my question is not sort of, if it reveals sort of some digesting that I still have to do on it. But I was interested in sort of your discussion of genre and implotment and narrative form and these questions of taxonomy, but also then the archival work and text as like a material body that is preserved and received and photographed. And I wonder if you could sort of address that more. You know, how do textual archives of manuscripts function within this conversation about taxonomy and preservation and discursive extinction?
Yeah. Well, when you're speaking about the question of recovery, my mind started to drift in that direction too. So thank you for that and for the question. Right, so I suppose there is some version of this that is, that on one hand, what I want to try to do by sticking close to a network of affiliations and references and like weird slippy references, is to track those metonymic connections that don't necessarily have that sense of metaphorical closure, and that also involve some potentially relationship of desire between the actors in the setting, in the kind of textual ecology or the milieu that we're talking about. But, you know, I don't want to frame that only in terms, even if I get excited by finding Oskson's first story, right? I don't want to frame that only in terms of a kind of recovery, right? The point and the reason I'm, even if it's an odd stretch, the reason I'm trying to think about the longer histories that are also a part of this milieu, right? This textual milieu, is to not treat the textual record as a collection of reified, stuffed objects, but to think about how they potentially open up lines of questioning that take us into the future. Does that get somewhere with you?
Yeah, thank you.
So, Catherine?
I have another non-question, thank you. I was just thinking, when you're talking in some of my own archival work, but also kind of questions around, I've been looking at Lewis and Clark quite a lot, but they were kind of scripted to find a like giant beaver, and this sort of relationship between the kind of imaginary giant beaver and Sacagawea and the sort of enslaved kind of person with them. And just trying to think about the sort of what the object or the fossil or the kind of text does in terms of, it's like a form of stabilization of value in relation to those kind of, you know, enslaved labor economies that are of kind of settler colonialism. And maybe I'd just be interested if you could say something about the sort of traffic between those two, between these kind of subjugating kind of forms and like the sort of desired object of the kind of being that is kind of part of the kind of quest for science, which is also, you know, obviously those kind of quests of settlement and so on. So like, yeah. In terms of scripting, what's the sort of movement between those two subject-object kind of relations?
Yeah. Thanks. So, the only other place that I've found, and this will come back, and this is going to be a little bit of a roundabout, but the only other place that I've found a reference to short-tailed rats in all of my researching has been in a story about Audubon's son, John Woodhouse Audubon. And it's a story about, it ended up in the footnote of this piece, about how the day after, and this is told in a memoir in the late 1880s, but it occurred mid-century. So John Woodhouse Audubon, when he was a teenager, shot his first deer, and they're in South Carolina, and the hunting party celebrated with a performance of all the younger hunters. And they sang songs and so on. And John Woodhouse Audubon performed in blackface, and he performed a song about a search for a short-tailed rat. And at the conclusion of the song, this minstrel performance, he pointed up to the wall where he had pinned a dead rat to the wall with its tail cut short. So there was something about when I was talking about the kind of diminution, the the fact that this, the object of desire in this story is rendered in, carries the connotations that it does, seems tied up with the racialization that's happening around, in its surround, right? So, in for me in the story, there's something about that description of Kitty Quist's employment history that really, I mean, he's getting by, right? He's figuring it out, but it's always done in the context of other people's scripts for him. Always might be too strong. I need to go back and think about it. But, right, he becomes, he does tricks for tourists, right? They involve a snake dance that seems not to correspond, and I speak as somebody who is not closely familiar with customary practice here. I speak as an outsider. But the way that Oskarson represents that snake, Kitty Quist snake dance, doesn't seem to correspond with accounts that I've been exposed to. He becomes a self-important white man's medicine doctor after sucking the joints of the governor. And then part of that I didn't include was that he failed to advertise, and so business fell off, and so he moves on, right? So there's this constant negotiation and inhabitation and ironization of the scripted roles that he's occupying. So I think there's something about Lake's desire for the rat of the Smithsonian's communication to Lake that he needs to find that rat that lines up in a weird way with the way that work and cultural performance are reified, or like unfortunately classified for Kitty Quist. Does that get there?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a, just as what that relation is a kind of, is a difficult kind of question. There's these kind of resonances and kind of potential. I mean, just thinking about what the modes of a redress might be, from the other sort of, to actually just the, I don't have a clear sense of what that relation is or how to maybe say that relation between that kind of the desired object and that labor. Right. I think that, so what I'm just, I think it's a struggle to just kind of in some ways clearly like articulate that relationship.
Yeah.
But it seems it matters very much as you were making very clear for how we might think.
Thank you. Yes?
Enjoyed your talk. Thank you. I was unaware of Oskarson, since it was interesting to learn about someone from Vanita. I think my question is, what do you know of, or in a broader project related to him, how do you work in his positionality in his community? Because it seems like his gaze for his storytelling is extra communal relations and not charity people. So then, in what ways is that him playing around with his own positionality, both in his career as a writer and in the Cherokee Nation, or are they not at all? Is it him just writing fiction that speaks to his experience in a broader sense?
Yeah, thank you. So he's a really interesting writer, and he's been, only within the last two decades have people started to read him again. There's been a little bit of scholarship coming out, and his unpublished autobiography, which is in manuscript, has been published by Nebraska with a big collection, including this story of his shorter works and political essays. He also, his final novel, The Singing Bird, was published by Oklahoma about 15 years ago. And it's interesting, in the foreword in the introduction to that volume, The Singing Bird, Jace Weaver says, he's just an assimilationist. he can't get past that. Timothy Powell and Melinda Smith Mullican, who edit the volume, disagree with that. Lionel Larrey says he's got a weird idea of amalgamation that kind of destabilizes assimilation, acculturation, and so on. So in terms of his kind of political positioning with regard to Cherokee history, that's a huge debate within circular history. Daniel Heath Justice says, like, he isn't always consistent. I do think what got me interested in this piece in part was, you know, a lot of Ostison's work does focus on Cherokee history, but also, for instance, The Singing Bird takes place in the mid-19th century, and it tracks, it actually focuses in some degree on white missionaries who come to Indian territory, but also the negotiating parties, Elias Boudinot, the Ridges, these are figures in that novel. So part of what got me interested in this story was like, what is he doing writing a story about Baha and a biologist? It didn't seem to fit. I think that part of it is, sure, like there's a sense of irony in play and he's exploring as a young writer. But I do think there are ways to embed it also in his experience at Stanford. The magazine for which he starts writing, he had published some short pieces in The Indian Chieftain in Vinita, but he also then starts publishing for The Sequoia, right? Which binds California flora and Cherokee history. And he is both represented by the institution as the first Native American graduate of Stanford University, and also in the Stanford Quad, which is an alum magazine, a few years after he graduates, they publish a story about his something he's published in an Eastern magazine, and the note says, although Ostison is often described as Cherokee, he's really white. I don't have much in terms of my archival evidence of how he understood his own status as a Cherokee citizen at Stanford, like, except in ways that he's writing about these questions of being, of the kind of objectification of subject positions. Thanks for the question.
I think we should break for lunch.